Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and in this podcast, I ask various people what 5 things from their life they would like to put in a time capsule to keep them safe. They choose 4 things that they love and 1 that they loathe, and we talk about them. My guest in this episode is the actor and writer Justin Edwards, who is probably best known as the character Ben Swain from the political comedy The Thick of It. But he's done loads of other things. Veep, Black Books, Diary of a Call Girl, Black Mirror and Father Brown on the telly, Newsjack, The News Quiz, Armando Iannucci's Charm Offensive and Cabin Pressure on the radio, and he won a Perrier Award in Edinburgh as Best Newcomer as part of the sketch trio The Consultants. He's also written for Horrible Histories, Double Science, and he wrote and performed in Miles Jupp's sitcom In and Out of the Kitchen. He's married to another of my guests on My Time Capsule, the stand-up comedian Lucy Porter. Now, recently, Justin was brilliant in Richard Curtis's film Yesterday, and he was about to become a member of the Royal Shakespeare Company when theatre came to an abrupt end. This did mean I could talk to him in his home via the internet, rather than driving all the way to Stratford to talk to him. See, every cloud has a silver lining, even a pandemic. So let's find out the 5 things Justin wants to put in his time capsule.
Sorry, that's my phone alarm. That's right. It's reminding me to call you. So I've done that, so I can turn it off now. There we are.
Lovely. Okay, Justin. So thanks for joining me. What's your first item?
This sounds decadent, but it's my hot tub.
Ooh.
which makes me sound very sort of, you know, makes me and the wife sound like we might have pampas grass in the front lawn and all sorts that we have a hot tub, but that kind of suburban couple. But it's a reasonably recent purchase. And how can I explain it? We rented a holiday cottage with some friends down in Devon, and they had a hot tub as part of the deal. Oh, well, whatever, who goes in a hot tub? A load of nonsense. But I really liked it. I thought, this is great. For whatever various reason, I said, we should get one of these. And Lucy said, no, ridiculous. They cost sort of 15 grand, these huge, big, plumbed-in things. And in fact, the house we live in had one in the garden. The previous owners, but one before us, had concreted over half the garden and had this huge hot tub in it, to much of the neighbours' dismay, because they used to sit late in it, sort of getting stoned and singing a bit loudly, I think. So it's always been a sort of slight thing of derision. But then my brother moved house in Cornwall, and he moved into a house which had a hot tub in the garden. And he also said, this is ridiculous. We're going to get this taken out. What a complete waste of money. Who sits in one of these? And he's been in it every day since, and that was 2 years later. So when we were around it, he's sitting in his hot tub, looking, and you can see, and just about see the sea as well, from if you really sort of peer over it. And I said, listen, we've got to get one. We should definitely get one. And she said, ridiculous. But then we found one in B&Q for £350 reduced. It's an inflatable one. They're not the big, huge. So it's like a giant paddling pool. And they're made by this company. I won't mention their name. They don't need to be advertised, but they're they do various ones. They've all got stupid names like the Hawaiian or the Honolulu and the kind of this slightly... We've got one of the wicker effect. I feel a bit sort of James Bondy. But it kept getting reduced and reduced. And eventually I went, look, it's only like £300. Let's get it. Also, my back was very bad at the time. And being the giant that I am, I don't have a bath that I can fit in. So the hot tub has become my bath. Not that I wash myself in it or sort of lie in there. But I'd lie in it for about an hour a day in the evenings, staring up at the stars and thinking. And I find it, I think it sort of offers a sort of zen-like place of retreat because you can't have your phone with you. You can't really do anything because you're effectively just lying in a big bath. But you are outside looking up at the world around you. And the kids love it. The kids will jump in and treat it like a sort of little mini swimming pool during the day, which during this period of isolation is very good because it's something else for them to do and to splash around and to run about. So it's become something of a sort of essential fixture, I would say, in my life, is that I have to go and lie in my hot tub every night for an hour. Otherwise, I don't feel like the day is complete.
How hot do they get? Are they like a bath?
Yeah, mine gets up to 40 degrees. That's the maximum, which is... pretty hot, actually.
It's a long time since I've been in a hot tub. I can't really remember it.
No, exactly. Well, I've spent, you know, most 90% of my life never being in a hot tub. In the last year, it's become my obsession. I keep trying to persuade everyone. I say, oh, you should get one. Everyone's got this slightly, really, you know, isn't it like just a sort of nasty soup of diphtheria and illnesses? And isn't it just a horrible mishmash of other people's bodily, isn't it? You know, and it's sort of associated with throwing your car keys in a bowl and a bit of a... But I can assure you, that's not how we proceeded with it in Pinner, although the magic of theatre. But yes, I don't know, but I'm all about the hot tubs. The kids that love it as well. But also all of our neighbours' kids come round and all just want to go in it because they come round, as it's tiny, but they can all get in. If they run round and round, they create a little whirlpool and they whoosh themselves round. And then you turn the bubbles on and they go, and then it kills a few hours. So it's all the parents sort of stare in bafflement. Well, I mean, it's a giant paddling pool, but it's full of hot water. That's the sort of way to...
Oh, fantastic.
I don't think I could live without it.
No.
Yeah, and it's very... we sit there as a family, and like I said, you know, we try and sort of play 20 questions and do mind-improving games with the children. And even it always sort of falls apart and ends up in an argument, but we try. But it is very, it's a means of escape as well. I used to love, when I go to the gym, I love sort of having a sauna afterwards, but also because I quite like being shut in a quiet hot room where you can't hear anyone talking on the phone, you can't do anything other than just sit there and enjoy the heat and go, and maybe have a vaguely sort of odd conversation with whoever else is in there, which only ever starts with the phrase, well, it's hot today, isn't it? Oh, it is, yes. So, and then it goes on from there. And sometimes you see the same people. I had a friend, I used to go to this, when we lived in Holborn, in the middle of town, and we had a very tiny bathroom, but we had a hotel next door to us, which had a very good gym and pool in the basement. And after 9 o'clock, everyone had checked out. It was a sort of businessy hotel. So every morning we'd go and have a lovely swim and a shower and use their fluffy bathrobes and towel and Molton Brown toiletries. So we didn't have to use our slightly. So we lived there for 6 years. And basically that was our sort of own private luxury bathroom. They had a very nice sauna and a steam. I used to go in and have a nice sort of sauna and a steam, everyone. You'd meet the same people in there at the same time every day. So over the course of a couple of years, I got people I got to know quite well, but only within the confines of a small wooden box when you're both sitting in your pants. And I wouldn't know what to say to them on the street.
Would you recognise them?
No, just through the fog. You're just vaguely peering at people.
Did the hotel not spot you all just every morning popping in?
No, we were gym members, but it was a surprisingly cheap gym.
Yes.
There was never anyone in the pool. I mean, the thing, again, after about 5 o'clock, once people had checked in, it got busy. And at weekends, it was full of people on hen nights and stuff. But during, you know, sort of, we had it to ourselves pretty much every morning, Monday to Friday. Mm.
Have you ever stayed in a hotel for any length of time?
I used to live in one.
Really?
I used to live and work in a hotel just outside Stratford-on-Avon. So yes, months on end living. I used to occasionally stay in sort of the same, it wasn't a big hotel, so I'd get a room if it wasn't booked out, or I'd just tend to stay in or go into whichever room was not taken that day.
Mm.
And I've done it obviously for filming jobs, yeah. You know. I've done sort of three or four week stints in hotels, and it's hard. I much prefer a sort of self-catering. Just being able to make yourself a piece of toast or something becomes a real desire after about week four.
Yeah. I once stayed in a hotel for 3 months, and I did turn into Alan Partridge.
Well, you do. You become obsessed with the minutiae of the room and what you can... Those long evenings of just... if I unscrew these paintings, will anyone notice if I turn them around the other way?
In fact, I almost got my own plate. It was that sort of, you know, where
that kind of, they give you that one.
I did sometimes go down to breakfast in a dressing gown. The staff knew me, so they just let me sit down and finish things off.
They probably still speak of you in hushed tones. Remember that mask? Oh, God. I'd come down in his dressing gown and pretend it was all right.
He thinks he's an actor.
Most people, they go and say, oh, I'm going to stay in a hotel. It'll be a bit of a jolly. And I'm almost like, oh, do you know what? I've spent so many days of my life on wet weather cover. I was doing a film in the Isle of Man, which involved me flying to and from the Isle of Man. I mean, once a week for about 6 weeks to film one tiny scene, because I'd always get them and go, I'm just going to hold you back because the weather's quite good, so we're going to shoot. Yeah, and so we'll just drop you back at the hotel. Fine. And there's really nothing to do in the Isle of Man. And this was in November as well.
Yeah, it can be dull, can't it? Although I do know somebody who went off to Yugoslavia, I think, and they'd hired him for the day, and he was put on a furlough for 6 weeks. Wow. And when he got back, his agent said, do you realise he had to renew the day payment every time?
Oh, that's quite good. So he did quite well.
Made a fortune.
Yeah, but he probably only took one pair of pants with him. That's the other.
Yeah.
Not travelling for 6 weeks stay would be a bit stuck. Well, I was in a self-catering apartment, in fact, for 5 months last year in New York, and that was quite maddening as well. You kind of lose the...
What were you doing there?
I was doing The Ferryman on Broadway, which was great, really good fun, really lovely show. And New York is great, and it's a wonderful place to be, but there's a reason why people go there for long weekends, because after about sort of 5 days, you're absolutely exhausted by the place, and you just think, I just need to sort of get off this island. It's incredibly dense, and it is an exciting and wonderful city, but then I sort of live in London. I don't wake up every morning going, right, I've got to go out and see everything. I must go to an art gallery. I must go. You think, no, it's pot around the garden. I've got things to do. Yeah. Whereas when you're living in a very small flat in the middle of Manhattan, you think, I've got to get out because I'll go mad otherwise. But then...
Yeah, that happened to me once. Somebody said, did you live in London? And I said, and at the time I did. I said, yes, I've always lived in London. And they said, oh, great, what's the Tower of London like? And I said, I don't know, I've never been.
No, I've never been either.
No.
No, I've never been to St. Paul's Cathedral. I used to live walking distance from St. Paul's Cathedral. Never went. I will one day, you know, that's what children are for, aren't they? Force you into these things.
Eventually.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Well, we'll put your hot tub into the time capsule. And electricity supply, keep it warm.
Yeah.
And for the bubbles.
Yeah.
Lovely. Okay. And you can jump in there and spin it round and turn it into a whirlpool anytime you like.
Absolutely perfect. Oh, well, I'll be fine.
Okay, good. So what's your second item?
Well, my second item, and I've got it here actually, as I picked this up, it's my late mother's recipe book. It's obviously a very fond emotional memory of my late mum who died sort of 6 years ago, because it's got a handwriting in it and it was all put together by her. So there's obviously those emotional ties to it as well. But it's also, she was a very good cook, and she would always sort of, so this is 1964, Juliet Ebb was August 1964 when she started doing it. And this was, you know, she was raising a family of three boys and living out in Pinner, I think. And the first thing in there is sort of a recipe for mushroom soup, which involves half a pound of mushrooms, one pint of milk, and everything, because it sort of then moves its way through the 70s. Everything is incredibly butter heavy and sort of dense. So I just sort of flick through. I don't really make much from it, but it's half a mix of her sort of handwritten recipes and then things she's cut out from various things. Like, oh, this looks interesting. And then has cut it out. And there's savory ideas for now or later, and, you know, pancakes with spinach, fried breast of lamb, beef goulash, Hungarian shepherd's pie, curry, just the kind of curry you would have made in 1966.
Yes.
There's only one.
Has it got raisins in it? Curry with raisins.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Raised pigeons and things. Did you ever make that? Why have you cut that one up? Lots of things trout with almonds, and it sort of moves its way up a little bit more into the 70s and 80s. But it's a kind of fascinating document of its time. Pigeons in tomato sauce. This is a handwritten one. Ingredients: 4 pigeons, 1 ounce of butter, 1 large onion. When did my mum ever cook us pigeons in tomato sauce? She's written it down, so it must have happened once.
After a trip to Trafalgar Square, I should imagine.
Yeah, split pigeons in two, first cutting down. I don't remember. She must at some stage, avocado pears and chestnut puree, all these kind of nice 70s things. But yeah.
So what did your mum do?
She was a nurse and... And then raised the three of us, and then ran a nursing home, was the matron of a nice nursing home just outside Winchester until she retired. So she sort of did all that. But she was extraordinarily, incredibly organized, as this kind of everything's so. And she ran lots of things and was always, you know, just very good at being on committees and doing things and organizing stuff. And was, you know, was sort of, yeah. So we'd never go to bed until the house was all done, cleaned, everything marvellous put away, and then we sort of treat herself to half an hour of extra admin. And but then she's very, very good at that kind of thing. But a tremendously good mother and grandmother, and, you know, an amazingly good cook as well. And she was, so me and my brothers grew up being very well catered for. And we've all, I think, sort of individually, in our own ways, become quite obsessed, but quite integrated. You know, we're all the main cooks in our households, because I think we're sort of...
That is unusual, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you're that organized all the time, because now everybody has cookbooks that are done by the top chefs, and everything is Jamie Oliver or Fernie Whittingstall and those sort of things.
Yeah, she's a big sort of Delia Smith fan and had a collection of cookbooks, but not huge, not sort of groaning shelves.
There weren't that many, really, I suppose, in that period. It wasn't a thing that you got everywhere. You might get a Reader's Digest copy of something, but that was it.
This is it. So she would cut the recipes out. So every magazine, all the good housekeeping things, or, you know, the recipes that you still sort of see in newspapers, she would diligently cut them out. Because, of course, if you couldn't find it, whereas now, when I've got a recipe for banana bread, which I've never written down, because I know every time I cook it, I go to my phone and I Google it, because it's the one that's the Guardian's best banana bread recipe, and I know it'll always be it. And I should write it down, because one day it might go offline and then I'm in trouble. But so, yeah, I think for my generation, the idea of I've got to cut that out of the newspaper and stick it in a book and keep it, otherwise I will never find that recipe again.
Yeah, yeah, it's a different world, the world of instant access that we have.
Yeah. And just the thing, well, I must, in fact, look at that. It was purely by that. I've opened it directly on her page for banana loaf, mashed three ripe bananas.
Is it better than The Guardian?
I had a cup of syrup raising. It's pretty similar to The Guardian one. Yeah. Oh, Grasmere gingerbread. Now that's interesting. I was looking for it. I could just sit here and go through this. Yeah,
just read the menus.
Walnut coffee meringues. You know, all these great sort of great things of. And I like to see this is one. This is one of her mother's writing, which is there. So that must have been Brack fruit bread.
Wow.
Oh, that's the one, yeah, where you soak tea and dried fruit, everything overnight, and then you make a... Yeah, gosh.
Have you ever thought of putting this together and publishing it?
The whole thing about my mother's... I don't think there's a dried apricot jam. It's quite a random selection. I quite like the strange nature of just going, oh, I wonder what's on this page. Oh. I mean, it's sort of arranged into puddings, but then it's not, because I've just gone from almond tart to stuffed tomatoes. So. But it's not dated after a certain... So I don't know when she sort of stopped. The last recipe in there is... Spanish angel pie, whatever that might be.
So, what is it?
Oh, it's a Baglioni.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's a very interesting sort of, you know, document of its time and of the, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the other book I was very tempted about, I've got Delia Smith's Complete Cookery Course that my brother bought me when I left home. I was 18 and went off to college in Stratford-on-Avon. He said, oh, you'll need this, in a kind of, you know, slightly emotional way that brothers do, and gave me, and I've had it ever since. It is really falling apart. And the children are always like, when you get a new one of those? Like, no, it's fine, because it's also got so much food actually on it. I think you could live on it. So I'd be tempted to include that with my mother's cookbook, just in a time capture, because you could dig it up and probably taste most of the things where it's been spilt on over the years. But every recipe, I've always gone, oh, if I need to find how to cook something, I'll just look it up in the Big Delia book first and we'll see.
Yeah. I wonder if every home has one of those, has a book that basically, if you really want to know how to cook something, that's where you go.
And when I still look at it, you know, two or three times a week, just any time, think, oh, I'm just doing a roast, you know, just what did she say about the best way to do that cut of beef? And there it is. And it's always sensible and tried and tested. And you think, yep, I'll follow that. Whereas my wife goes off-piste with her recipe. She doesn't like to follow a recipe.
No, mine neither.
And it's with, you know, varying results, if I'm honest. Yeah, so that cookery book and possibly the Delia Smith as well, bundled together, held together with as many elastic bands as they need to stop them falling apart.
Lovely. Well, I'll put them in there, but I won't put them by the hot tub in case they get wet.
Yes, no, you couldn't. Yeah, that's the other thing. You can't read in the hot tub. You can feel no guilt about doing nothing, because you can literally do, all you can do is nothing. And I think it's quite good to have enforced nothingness.
Yes, no phones, no iPads.
Well, all I can do is lie here in the heat and enjoy it. With no feeling that I should be doing anything else.
All right, that's two items we put into the time capsule. So what's your next item? Right, we'll be back in a minute, but first, here are some adverts.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back. Okay, right, let's find out what the third thing is that Justin Edwards would like to put in his time capsule.
My third item, this is a drive that my wife and children and the cats mad, is a banjo.
Do you play the banjo?
I do, and it's I haven't been playing for long. I've been playing for about 6 months, and it's incredibly difficult, but very rewarding, and I don't think I'll ever be able to master it, so it should go in a time capsule, because then I could just, you know, then it could go on forever.
But I always think with the banjo that people mistake it for, well, they think it's as easy as a ukulele.
No, it's impossible, because I've played the guitar for sort of 30 years now, and I'm a reasonably good guitarist. Things like ukulele, I'm not that keen on ukuleles. I know that's probably a term, but they seem to be everywhere, and they are fine, and they are fun, and they're easy to play, and I can see why people, but the, yeah. That doesn't mean they should be played all the time. That's my feeling. But no, it's so different to the guitar, because I haven't played the guitar for a long time. I thought, oh, well, I'm going to move to the banjo. I'm going to treat myself to a banjo and do this properly and have some lessons. I found a very good teacher. And no, it's like starting again from scratch. There's a bit of crossover, but just between the, you know, your left and right hand dissonance. But other than that, you're doing such different things with your right hand than you do on the guitar and with your left hand. So it's it's a whole new instrument.
So it's not really a strumming instrument, is it?
You can do strumming ones. You can tell a man, you can strum along in those kind of Kenny Ball jazzmen kind of ding 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 sort of ragtime things. But the actual finger picking, the bluegrass ding 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 finger picking stuff is, and you only use two fingers and your thumb, and that's it. And then it's all done with the hammer-ons and the pull-offs. So you get this incredibly complex, fast sound. Well, that's the theory. I've yet to achieve it. But great, great pace. But when you do, it's yes, it's surprisingly rewarding. My banjo teacher is very good, obviously, and he said you watch people playing, you watch these videos of kind of Earl Scruggs and Lester Flatt, these famous banjo players, mm-hmm. and they have a sort of almost beatific smile on their face and staring into the middle distance, because you must have seen, you know, sort of guitar mouth that you get when your tongue falls out when you're playing the guitar, yeah. And drummers get a slightly lot because you're concentrating on other bits of you stop being paid attention to. Where in the banjo equivalent of that is just a completely blatant face, because you're thinking so hard about what your right hand is doing and this constant driving rhythm that if you get it wrong, it sounds wrong very quickly. And then you're thinking, oh, the left hand, and you sort of, again, maybe it's like the hot tub thing, there's sort of zen, like you reach a moment of going, I just have to keep playing this now, because if I stop, then it just all falls apart. It's a very unforgiving instrument. You can't just go, oh, I'll just pick it up and strum a few chords, because if you get it wrong, it sounds really sort of discordantly.
And it must be amazing to get to that point that very few people do with any instrument, where you really aren't thinking about playing it at all. You just play it.
Yeah, and I can see the appeal of, I went to see, there's a famous banjo player called Bella Fleck, who's an quite extraordinary musician, and just plays it like a, you know, it makes it sound like a sitar, like a harp, like anything. It's absolutely incredible. But you watch him play, and again, he's a very quiet, mild-mannered man, but just this sort of look of complete stillness on his face while he's producing this astonishing noise. You just go, I had no idea how you're playing that many notes that quickly and that precisely and that incredibly, and yet it sort of vaguely look like you're staring out of a train window thinking about what's for dinner. You know, it's such a kind of... So maybe one day I'll reach that level of mastery, but it will take a long time, I think. That's why it's,
It can be a really haunting sound, though, can't it, a banjo?
Predominantly a jaunty sound, I'd say, but then you can sort of get. Again, I'm not sure. It's one of those instruments I think might be more fun to play than to listen to, but I used to sing in a Georgian choir as well, if you've ever come across that sort of Georgian polyphonic, long, low-held notes and people doing discordant sort of noises over the top of it, which was really good fun, really lovely, but... My friends were due to come and watch it, and my parents would come and listen. And they go, oh, yes, it's quite, yes, that's quite interesting. Where should we go for dinner? Because after an hour of it, as an audience member, I'm not sure, but you can, as being in the choir and singing, it's tremendous because you get all these different noises going on and really satisfying way to sing in these strange harmonies. But
the audience are thinking, any minute now, there's going to be a tune.
There'll be something we can recognise as a tune, and then maybe it'll stop.
Maybe we can clap along.
I get the measure late at night, so I practice, sort of get the kids to bed, and I try and move myself to the remotest part of the house. I won't wake the neighbours up. And the cats look so upset when I get the banjo out.
I'm a bit worried that your fingers are all going to be so crinkly, having spent so long in the hot tub.
Well, I know, this is it. Yeah, it doesn't combine well with the hot tub. I have to tub with my hands in the air.
All right, well, that's it. Let's put your banjo into the time capsule and you can sit there on the edge of the hot tub and practice for hours. It's not going to disturb anyone. Okay, so we've got two more items to go.
It was interesting, just having mentioned, weirdly, Stratford-on-Avon, and we talked about it earlier because I'm supposed to be there at the moment, I'd like to put in, Stratford-on-Avon in 1990. I'd like to just gently slide that into the time capsule as a very happy time.
Is this when you were working in the hotel?
Yeah, I went to college in Stratford-on-Avon, South Warwickshire College of Further Education, as it was then. It's called something else now. And I did this sort of year-out course, called the year-out drama course, which is still being run by this extraordinary lady called Debbie Moody, who is this sort of ball of energy and passion and things. She's run this course mostly for sort of disenfranchised children who want to sort of act, but their parents go, no, I don't think that's a good idea. Go and do this for a year. Get out of your system. And it doesn't work because it just puts it further into your system. But it was also because it was when I left home. I was sort of 18 and went to live. And I lived in a tiny cottage in Stratford, just sort of behind Shakespeare's birthplace, shared it with three other students we'd never met before. We all just turned up aged 18 with our bags and said, oh, I'm just Noel Holm, I'm Nick, I'm there. All right. And then we all started this insane sort of drama course the next day, which involved huge amounts of physical things and dancing around and making masks. And of course, it was wonderful because we were 18 and we had all the freedoms of leaving home and all the freedoms of doing this amazingly good, fun thing. It was like a sort of constant. Because it was for the people that actually enjoyed drama lessons at school. My school didn't really have much going on in terms of artistic. It wasn't really bothered by it. But they grudgingly, you had like one drama lesson a week where you'd sit around and an English teacher would let you play Wink Murder or you'd sort of devise plays. But it was all a bit. But I loved it. That was the bit I really looked forward to. So to then have that for and ultimately as a career, of course. Mm. But I think that in particular that being 18, as we all know, is a you don't realise it at the time, but it's wonderful because you're so kind of physically capable of everything. Nothing hurts. You can go out every night, drink yourself under the table, and you're absolutely fine by 9 o'clock the next morning, which we did a lot of that. And everything's fun, everything's new, everything's exciting, and you think you're the first person to ever have discovered all these, you know, wonderful feelings and emotions. And so, yeah, it's a very epic, and there's no real responsibility at 18. Well, there is, but it's not. You don't really have the concerns about sort of children and mortgages and sort of the expense and difficulties of life that are a long way away when you're 18.
The absolute assumption at that age is that they're going to take care of themselves anyway, that it'll be fine.
Yeah, it'll all be fine, and we're immortal. Mm. And so spending that year, particularly as well in Stratford, which was, and is, as you know, it's a terribly pleasant, twee, quiet sort of market town with this extraordinary sort of vroomph of the theatre and the whole world of Shakespeare sort of thrown upon it. So it's become, you know, it's a very strange place to live because it is slightly unreal. It was a little bit more real in 1990 because it was still, yeah, you could still buy a pint of milk on the high street, which I don't really think you can now in Stratford. I think everything is, you know, the oldie tea shop and whatever. It's very, you know, it's not quite as. But yeah, so we lived right in the middle of all that world. And I'd wake up in the morning and sort of wander around the corner with a fag on, walk past Shakespeare's birthplace, buy a pint of milk, walk back again. And you think this is, you know, and with the sort of 400 Japanese tourists all just frantically sort of taking. And again, it was it was pre mobile phones and pre internet. So I think I had much more freedom as an 18-year-old than I suspect you do these days, because nothing was recorded or documented. There wasn't any pressure of the social media. And you lived in a smaller world. You could sit in a pub, and I was sort of lamenting this with someone the other day, probably in a pub. You could sit in a pub and spend 4 hours with five of you around a table trying to remember the name of, who was it who played that, the thing, you know, that sort of conversation whereby you're all desperately trying to piece together some half-remembered memory of your childhood, which of course now, you Google instantly, nothing, everything's at your fingertips. Whereas I sort of miss that joy, that communal joy of people sort of reminiscing or trying to recover shared experiences. Mm.
Your description of Stratford when you were 18, to me, is the description of working at the Royal Shakespeare Company. That's exactly what it's like, is you lose all sense of responsibility. You just drink, you drink all night, and you work all day, and you go to classes. It's ridiculous. I've never been involved in anything quite so totally consuming.
Yes, no, I think it is wonderful, and I was very much looking forward to be doing that as we speak.
You would have been doing the tech rehearsal for the Comedy of Errors.
Yeah, this very week, I think. It will come around, it will come again, but I think certainly those, and I was interested, we went back to, we went to Stratford a few months ago to check out the accommodation and do various other admin tasks at the theatre. And I did wander around going, gosh, it really hasn't changed that much, really structurally and aesthetically. Go, no, this is very, very similar to, you know, how it felt when I was 18.
Mm. Yeah, I fell in love with acting in Stratford. I went on a boat trip, and I saw Ian McKellen in playing Romeo. It gives you some idea of how long ago it was. Yeah. And from that moment, I was hooked. That was it.
No, same. Yeah, a lot of the shows I saw from 1990 onwards. There was an amazing ensemble. Always amazing ensembles there, but it was a very strong year. I saw some great productions there.
Do you remember any of them?
What did I see? John Wood giving his King Lear. That was very good. Was Simon Russell Beale, and they did a brilliant production of The Seagull with Roger Allam, Simon Russell Beale, and Kate Fleetwood. And that was extraordinary. I saw that about three times. I thought it was so impressive. Lots of just great things.
Mm.
That Seagull production was absolutely astonishing. I always remember that as being very, very good. I've then since worked with almost everyone who was in that production. And the first thing I ever said to them is, I saw you in this film. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, it was quite good. It was Terry Hand's last thing he directed at the RSC. And I was thinking, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen on stage. And they were going, oh, it was quite good, that. Yes, I remember.
It's never the same for the people in it, is it?
We had, when I was doing The Ferryman in New York, we had a lot of, repeat visitors, if that's the word, who come and see the show a lot of times, because people that really liked it, and those that didn't, but... And we had this one young girl who was, I think, Korean, and she came, I don't know how she afforded it, but she came two or three times a week, I would say, and saw the play. It was absolutely obsessed with it. Got tattoos of it done on her body when it finished, and would sort of shower us with strange gifts. So it was totally kind of, in love with it.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, I get that with the kind of music. People go and see Les Mis and Phantom of the Opera and things time and time again, and you have a certain affinity with it, and you can... Well, those things, that kind of thing, I think bears repetition. Yes, I would go and see Les Mis with a new cast in it, because it's kind of interesting to see, or go, it's like revisiting, certainly with music, it was like revisiting your favourite album or listening, But I don't know that I could watch the same play more than three or four times.
You'll never make a director then.
No, exactly.
And Stratford is a lovely town.
It is, and it's slightly unreal. It's a bit like sort of a little toy town thing. You get that, the train stops at the edge of town. Once you're there, you can't get back. You can't leave.
No, no train after 10 o'clock, and all the plays finish at 10:30, so it's deliberate.
Pubs close, close a bit later, so, it's very well engineered. Yes, you have to go and stay in a nice B&B in a hotel somewhere, and then, of course, you have to potter around the shops the next day and go to Lakeland Plastics and buy yourself, something. So it's very,
I like the fact that it's a very different town at different seasons. So in the winter, it can be quite empty, really.
Yeah.
Because the great thing about being an actor there is that all the accommodation provided by the Royal Shakespeare Company is within just stumbling distance of the stage door.
I know. The one I've got booked, which I would be in at the moment if I were there, is one of those ones on Waterside. Literally, you're just so close to the theatre that there's no excuse for being late. Or indeed, but also so close to the theatre, every excuse for just, I'll have one more drink because I don't really have to travel very far tomorrow.
Well, in lieu of the fact that you really should be there now, I'm going to definitely put that lovely year, 1990.
1990, yes.
In Stratford. You're going to have that all again. So we have one more item. Unfortunately, this is an item that you really don't want, that one that you're glad to bury in the ground, literally.
The only thing I would bury, and this is because I just had a reason, is personalised number plates, which is something of a personal obsession.
Really?
I don't know why. I think I live in an area, it's very nice, really, very quiet, sort of, suburban cul-de-sac. A lot of people have huge, unnecessarily large 4x4s. They're all sort of leased around here. And everybody on this tiny street seems to have a huge one of those sort of Porsche Cayenne things, or massive, great... And I don't know what you do with it. People don't really drive. We're on the sort of commuter belt in and out of town. I don't know if people drive to work a lot. I mean, they take their kids to school in it, which, we've got people who live next door to us who drive their children to school. every day in this giant 4x4. And we get there before them because we walk to school because it's a 5-minute walk. And yet they will insist on, and you just think, I don't know. And my wife is always going, oh, give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they've got to go straight on to work, or maybe they've got mobility issues. And I'm like, no, they haven't. They've just spent a stupid amount of money on this car. They've just realized they're not going to use it unless they go to and from. Anyway, but no, it's the personalized number plate thing. I've always found them to be the sort of lowest level of absolutely pointless vanity.
Yes.
That human beings can reach, because they do nothing for your car. They don't improve the safety of it. They don't make it faster. There's absolutely nothing other than saying, I've got another 10 grand spare to stick this on the back. And it's a word that looks very slightly possibly like my surname, or has some tenuous connection with.
Yeah, the profligate waste of money is always annoying, isn't it?
I'd rather just spend the money on, you know, have some new tyres put on. That'd be more used to everyone and more safe in the big scheme of things. But I don't know why. I just find them very, and there are so many around here. They've always, you know, and it's always like a Jazz F drive, you know, and it's always someone in a BMW driving very close up behind you. And then that's where you can see their number plates perhaps more often as they overtake you around a blind corner in a quiet suburban road. But it was, yeah, they seem to be very married together. And, you know, aggressive driving and sort of thoughtlessness tied in with personalized number plates do seem to. I think you'd pay quite handsomely for a number plate. I mean, they go for lots of money as well. That's sort of, you know.
Yeah, tens of thousands, I think.
If you can afford to spend £10,000 on a piece of metal to stick on your car that does nothing than advertise the fact that you've got 10 grand spare, then go and give it to charity or go and do something useful with it.
Yeah.
We also had a slight, quite interesting altercation. I was trying to cross the road with the kids the other day, and a man drove very, it's on a 20-mile-an-hour road, and he had a very loud, sort of low-slung sports car. And I slightly fed up with it, and I just sort of waved my hands as he walked past, going, slow down, because it really was a bit much. And then he came to a stop with a screech of tyres, and I thought, all right, this is going to be interesting. And I had the kids with me, and I thought, I don't think he's going to start spoiling for a fight. I am also the size of a house.
You're a big man, yeah.
yeah. And he just reversed back and just looked at my left and said, yeah, I said, sorry, just, you know, it's a 20-mile limit. I'm trying to cross the road with the kids. And he was insisting. He says, right, I know, right, it sounds like it's going a lot faster because it's got such a powerful engine, but I was only doing 90 miles an hour. I was just so staring. You clearly weren't doing 90. But also this idea that, no, I'm completely in the right. It's just my car just sounds amazing. That's why you thought it would go fast. And as he drove off, his number plate was D-I-N-O-S, Dinos, and then number 7, or Dinos 7, or Dinos 8.
Yeah.
I thought, I could creep around his house and so easily change that to penis with a Sharpie, and it would be very. And he probably wouldn't notice if he did it on the back number plate.
Yeah, you can get away with things like that. I did once shout at a van driving the wrong way down a one-way street outside of my house, yeah, very fast. And I was just about to cross the road with my children and the shopping. And I grabbed the children at the last minute, and this thing zoomed by, and I shouted out, "This is a one-way street, you wanker!" And there was that screech of brakes. Yeah. And he got out, and he very slowly walked towards me. Nothing I could do, and he walked up, and he punched me in the face.
No way.
Mm. He was arrested and lost his job, but, you know.
Good. Yeah. No, I always think, I've got safer, I've got the kids with me kind of thing. You'd have to be a very particular type of person to, you know, start a fight in front of two small children.
And yes, well, he was one of those people.
Wow. But I guess once you're driving at speed the wrong way up a one-way street, you've kind of your sense of morals are fairly far gone anyway, aren't they? Yeah,
I think he did argue afterwards that he had to drive fast because he was breaking the law, so he needed to get it over and done with.
In my defence, Your Honour, I had stolen the van, and I knew that I had to.
I had to get it off the streets as quickly as I could, so of course I went at 80 miles an hour down the high street.
But yes, but anyway, so my firm belief is that, and I will stand by it, that anyone with a personalised number plate is ultimately selfish and unpleasant and a bad driver. I mean, I know it's a strong opinion, and I'm sure, I say this actually, our neighbours in the sort of charming have got a couple of personalised number plates with their kids' names on them, and they couldn't be lovelier, so I can't really make that argument stick. But if you want people to know that what your name is or the profession you're tenuously involved in, which may somehow relate to your, then you could just paint that on the side of your car or sort of wear a hat with your name on. I know it does seem a bit. Well, no, it's not done in any other sort of branch of life. People don't walk around with, like you say, a sort of badly spelt version of their name on a T-shirt. And go, yeah. You haven't got M1KE just sort of, look at this, look. Maybe you have.
I couldn't afford it. Well, I'm quite happy to put personalised number plates because they clearly rile you.
They do.
Yeah, and I'm going to put them in there, but we're going to bury them deep. They're gone. So, Justin, thank you so much. It's been really lovely to talk to you.
And you, Mike. Thanks very much.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Michael Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Justin Edwards. You can subscribe to this podcast for free to stream all episodes on Acast or your own favorite podcast provider. And if you have the time, we'd really appreciate it if you could rate us and write a short review. Thanks. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook for all the latest about My Time Capsule. Just search at MyTCPod, or you can follow me at Fenton Stevens. My Time Capsule is a cast-off production. The producer was John Fenton Stevens, and the music was by Pass the Peas Music. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.